Hey, everybody. Thanks for joining us back here on Bikes and Big Ideas on the Blister Podcast Network. I'm David Golay, the bike editor at Blister and host of the show, and you can check out everything we are doing and reviewing over at blisterreview.com. Norco hasn't been at all secretive about the fact that they are working on a new World Cup downhill race bike for their team, and because they've been showing off that bike and its development out in the open, I thought it would be a fun one to sit down with Norco engineers Adrian Ward and Kirk McDowell to talk about the project and what they've done with the design and testing of the bike, how they got there, including the early development that they did making an adapted version of their range enduro bike that the team is racing on for a while, and of course bringing on Greg Minnaar and having him join with the bike development already well underway, getting him up to speed on the bike, and a whole lot more. It's a pretty fun one, and Adrian and Kirk do a really good job of peeling back the curtain on what goes into designing and testing and tuning a World Cup downhill race bike. So, think you're really going to enjoy it. I sure did. But before we get into it, I do want to take a quick minute to encourage you to check out our Blister Plus membership, which includes a whole lot of great stuff, including the ability to send us off an email and get your own personalized recommendations on your next bike or gear upgrade or whatever else it is that you might need help with in terms of bike setup and whatever else. So there's a link in the show notes. Check that out. And as you're getting geared up for the riding season that is well underway a lot of places in the Northern Hemisphere now, it's a big help. So have a look. And with that, let's get right to my conversation with Adrian Ward and Kirk McDowell of Norco. Well, Adrian, Kirk, great to sit down and chat, and looking forward to hearing some more about the DH bike that you guys have been working on for, well, a good while now, I guess. But before we get into that, can you two please just introduce yourselves, tell me a little bit about what you do at Norco, and take it from there.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, great to be here as well. Great to speak to you. So I'm one of the senior development engineers here at Norco. I've been with Norco now three and a bit years I've been with Norco. Been doing that role the whole time there. And before that, my background is actually from motor racing. So I came into this from motor racing previously to that, and I've been outside of the bike industry for about 10 years before that. But I was back in the day, as I call it now. I used to work with SRAM in the UK in their technical center. So that was kind of my first background into bikes. And then with Norco this end, really, we kind of say that I'm kind of heading up anything on the bike side of the technical side here with Norco. Just kind of taking responsibility for the development of the downhill bike.
Right on. Thanks, Adrian. Kirk, how about you?
Yeah, so I've been with Norco for 2 years now, and my role is a development engineer. So Adrian explained, I guess we're sort of on this R&D side of our engineering structure at Norco, and then we've got another side that's sort of our like production design side. So I guess my role as it kind of pertains to this downhill project is providing engineering support where I can, but also doing a lot of the test riding for the bike. So
okay, right on. With that, I guess time to sort of get into a bit about the bike itself, and I don't quite know where the best place to start is here, because there have been some bits and pieces about prototypes floating around for a while, but arguably the story here kind of starts with the range that's been out for a few years now, and that primarily marketed as an enduro bike, but you guys had adapted it into a DH bike that the team was on for a bit as well. And so I guess I'll kick it to you. Where do you kind of see the development of the what is now the current prototype DH bike having really started, I guess? And where did we begin from to get here?
I think you've kind of grabbed the idea already there. It really was range where this current bike can trace its roots back to. I guess a little bit of Aurum HSP in there as well. But certainly the race bike, we like to call it the race bike here firstly, like rather than a prototype, because we very early at the outset of this project set out that this was going to be a bike only for racing. You know, if a production bike drops out, that's cool. But, you know, what we wanted to do was make sure that we had the best bike for racing, you know, untied by any commercial project, which we can talk more about that as well, because that's quite interesting. But yeah, Range was really where this came from. Obviously, Range shares some layout similarities with this bike, certainly being a bike with a lot of axle path. And yeah, so that's where this layout really started from. I mean, we had Range as an enduro bike, and we were kind of lacking on having a downhill bike. So we did some kind of custom linkages for the Range to get the travel and to bump it up to be a downhill bike. And then really, I guess, probably would have been late 2021, we were kind of realizing some limitations with Range. Like, we were just at the end of the development path of Range. There was nothing else we could do, you know, to get any more development out of it. And that simultaneously came along with an ask from the company for us to increase our focus on downhill racing. And also, very conveniently, Kirk joining us as a high-level downhill athlete. And that's then when we kind of then stepped into making a change to the bike and to move away from the Range. But this bike is definitely an evolution of Range.
Yeah, right. And I guess before we get into the details of the current race bike in greater depth, would be curious to hear a bit more about the DH version of the Range. Was adapting it into being a viable downhill race bike kind of part of the plan with that bike from the beginning, or was that something that came about a little bit more organically as you were making your way through kind of figuring out what you wanted to do with it and just getting a race bike for the team as it existed at that point and so on? Or how did that part of the Range story kind of come together?
To be honest, it does sort of very slightly predate both me and Kirk on when the decision making there, but I was involved in kind of some of the design work early on with some iterations of the Range downhill bike. But I don't think it was ever really on plan for that to become the downhill bike. I think we reached some pretty serious limitations with the bike before that. And we knew we needed to do something, and we had a couple of directions we could obviously go for a full new project. But at the time, Range, you know, we looked at it and thought that, you know, there's some promise here. There's some things that we could look into. And obviously we went in that direction. And equally, I think at that time, we probably had a very slightly different focus on our racing side. We were, you know, spread between cross country and downhill. So, you know, slightly different resources available to do that at the time. Kirk raced on the Range downhill. So maybe he's got some thoughts on the downhill version of the Range.
Yeah, I mean, I was looking back on it, like, you could tell that it was an enduro bike that had sort of been converted to a downhill bike, which is, kind of where I first landed when I rode it. You know, it felt fast and it worked really well on some local tracks and stuff like that. But to me, I was always like, I feel like this thing would be quite taxing to ride on a World Cup track. It felt fast, but it just wasn't super comfortable. And that came down to just being sort of up against a wall, I guess, into like what we could do with that layout and in terms of making it into a World Cup level like DH bike. So we just found that we were kind of using a bit shallow travel and you know, due to that bottom bracket concentric link, we weren't able to really move the pivots around, I guess, any further to, like, you know, the bottom bracket, like, might be dragging on the ground or hitting the tire or something like that before we could get it to where we wanted to be. So, yeah, we were kind of up against a wall there, and like Adrian said, got it as far as we kind of could. But, yeah, definitely wanted to continue some of those, like the axle path and that kind of characteristics that we liked from that bike over to the new bike.
Yeah, I think we were sitting there thinking we know exactly where we want to go here, and we just couldn't. You know, you look at the way you want to place the points on the bike or how you want the layout of the bike to be, and you can't. And you've got a carbon production bike, so you know you can't just go and cut a new mold for that, you know, straight away. And especially to try something, you know, to spend that money to be like, oh, this might work, I might not. And I think that really speaks to why we ended up going for the aluminium mule and then even the aluminium race bike now. You know, that adaptability and the ability for us to pivot and try things, you know, and experiment is, you know, that's why we ended up moving away from range and going the way we are now.
Right. So, I mean, would it be fair to say that the biggest limitations of sort of where you could take the range in converting it to a DH bike just had to do with suspension kinematics and your ability to fine-tune some of that stuff? Because as you said, you can make different lengths to change things a bit here and there, but you're still constrained by the points where those links tie into the carbon molds and mainframe, and yeah, there's only so far you can stretch that.
Exactly, yeah, and we'd already gone as far in the direction we wanted. There are definitely other limitations with riding range as a downhill bike. You know, there's elements which are great on a production bike, where you take it apart twice a year, let's say twice a year, like some people might, you know,
at the high
compared
end,
to
yeah,
a bike that mechanics working on every single day. Yeah. You know, compared to a bike that's being checked every single run and taken apart every single day, you know, there are also operational implications there as well that we wanted to kind of correct in the new bike, because, you know, I always say your resource limited when you're at the track. You know, you've only got so many people and so much time, and the efficiency of how you use that time is what, you know, can give you a performance benefit over other people. So there was also limitations like that that meant we just really wanted to stop using that frame.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that bit's interesting, but makes sense too, you know, stuff like, I mean, are we talking just things like, for example, external cable routing for the brake, or more in-depth things of pivots and kind of how the hardware goes together and that kind of stuff as well, or what are we talking there?
Yeah, for sure. I think, you know, that's a very obvious one, is the external cable routing. You know, you need to change a brake, and you know, you want it to be a 2-minute job, not a 40-minute job. You know, I saw one of our mechanics changing a front triangle between final practice and the race run for an athlete, and you know, and I remember him saying, "It's done, it's together, you know, I hope it stays together," you know, and because of that pressure of trying to change everything on a front triangle, which again, that was a kind of a carbon front triangle thing as well there. So there was some, you know, some impact damage on that. We obviously couldn't say that was safe to race, so we had to change it. The aluminium is a little bit more forgiving in those sense. You know, it's much more obvious of the damage. You know, you don't need specialist techniques to look for the damage. But yeah, there is other things like that, you know, having all of the bolts accessible from the outside, you know, so a mechanic can just put a tool onto it without taking a wheel out, or, you know, having to have a special tool. And, you know, yeah, it's a lot of those kind of operational mechanic kind of hands-on things that we wanted to make easier on this bike, to win ourselves back some time, because I would much rather the mechanics are thinking about suspension setup, you know, and tuning, or, you know, than, you know, I need to rebuild the back end of that, and it's going to take me ages, you know.
No, I mean, that all makes very good sense. And so I guess from that point, I think we kind of got a, you know, decent rundown on sort of where you were at with the range DH bike conversion, and had some ideas of things that you wanted to improve upon for a dedicated DH race bike platform. Where did the development of the bike that we see now start from that point? I mean, what were the first iterations like? It sounds like you had some ideas of what you wanted to improve upon, but what did those first versions of it like or look like, and how different was the early development of what became this current bike to the early iterations, and how did that all evolve?
Yeah, coming out the back of the range, actually, one of the first things we did, which is quite interesting, is to make sure we were asking the right questions, because we knew we wanted to try this leverage curve, and we wanted to try to do this with anti-rise, anti-squat, geo, whichever. But we wanted to make sure that we were asking all of those questions really holistically. So we actually started by doing a big piece of work where we Yeah, we come out of this range bike, which was a production bike, you know, a bike that you want to be good as an enduro bike, good in a bike park, converted to a downhill bike, tried to be good there. And we knew that we wanted to go and develop a bike, which was going to be a downhill race bike, first and foremost. You know, whatever comes after that is fine, but first and foremost, it's a race bike. And a race bike's requirements are very, very easy in a way. It just has to be the fastest bike at these 10, 8, whatever tracks per year. And that's it. You know, it's a lot easier than when you're trying to make something that works in Europe, works in Australia, works in America, you know, as an enduro bike. So we wanted to go back and actually think about, okay, well, what does make a race bike fast? You know, from everything from frame, components, you know, and what's their kind of the relevant weighting of those different things? You know, how important are they to the pace of a bike? And what then are our questions about that? You know, what comes out of that of us thinking, okay, well, we're not quite sure actually on that. You know, BB drop, we think we know this, but actually what happens at each end of the spectrum? You know, so we did a big long piece of work just thinking through all these different things. And then coming out of that, that kind of drove our design brief for the mule. You know, these are the open questions that we've got. And then we got into, and we knew that we wanted to mule this thing. You know, create a really highly adjustable bike, you know, more so than you would want for setup at a track, you know, actually for kind of, you know, experimental, you know, scientific experimentation. So that really then drove what we wanted to do on the mule. And we ended up having the aluminium mule built. And that was built kind of, you know, with a local third party here in Canada. And Kirk actually then raced that bike for a year. So we did a whole summer of work on that bike, got the bike, and then did a summer of work around various different bike parks and tracks, mainly local to us. And then to continue with that, what we did is Kirk then just went and raced it. Because what we needed to do, say earlier, this bike needs to be fast at all of these tracks. There was no point in us really going to Cyprus and making the fastest bike down Cyprus, or going to A-Line and making the fastest bike down the A-Line. You know, we needed to be the fastest bike in Val d'Isle, Fort William, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So then the next stage of the development project after that was then to put Kirk on the bike and go racing with it and start to experiment at the races and gather data at the races. So that was kind of the next step there.
Well, I guess a lot I want to dig into about that, but Kirk, before I start asking too many more questions, tell us a bit about how that period of racing went and what you learned from that.
Yeah, well, I remember the first day that I got on that mule. I think we were in Worcester Bike Park and we were riding the like Pancras racetrack that you would ride there for a test day. And just thinking that it felt like a trophy truck compared to what I was coming off with the range gauge. And I feel like a big thing for me with the downhill bike is you kind of want to be able to just stand there like and just have the bike take up all the rough, you know, in those chundery sections. So it was a exciting first day on it. We had it all kind of wrapped up with our fancy little cover and lineup, and it was turning some heads. So it was a fun day in the bike park. But and then you know, later in the year taking it racing at the World Cups. I think that was kind of like Adrian said, was needed to, you know, really test it where we're designing it to be raced. So we kind of spent that summer working through a multitude of adjustments that we had on the bike. Like Adrian was saying, you know, because it was kind of an engineering project and was sort of kept within our team, we were able to put a lot of like pretty crazy adjustment into the bike. And so we were testing like bottom bracket drop, all sorts of progression, and front and rear center adjustments and idler based adjustments, just for the goal of like finding what we wanted to sort of be our baseline going forward into the team race bike. Obviously, you don't want to kind of maintain a huge level of complexity for sort of weight and just ease of maintenance and stuff with the race bike. So yeah, we wanted to zero in on, you know, our like kind of baseline or middle setting, and then maybe have a small adjustment from there, or in cases like the bottom bracket height adjustment, just do away with that completely, so that yeah, we just could remove that complexity and weight from the race bike.
And it's super exciting as well, because each of those, what we managed to do on the mule, which is one of our really early on aims, was to make sure that each of those adjustments was completely in isolation. So there's a few little clever ways of doing on the bike that Colin, our other development engineer here, came up with. There's a few clever ways of doing that, and a few fairly obvious ways of just, you know, making some of these adjustments in isolation. But everything that we change would not interfere with anything else. So we really had this scientific, you know, ethos of just, you know, make one change and see what happens, you know. So we weren't changing reach and affecting stack, you know, we were even correcting for that in the head tube cups there, and the same with the kind of progression. We were kind of being able to move progression around and not, you know, change any of the other characteristics of the bike, which allowed us to really dig in and learn stuff. And there was a, you know, quite a few of those things, to be fair. I think as a sport we're starting to get to a point where we're getting much closer to knowing what's needed than we were, you know, even 5 years ago. So a lot of that stuff, we got there and we were like, yeah, you know, we were pretty right. Actually, maybe we wanted 1 to 4 and we had 5, you know, or we wanted 2 to 4, 5, you know, whatever. And there were some of them where we were super interesting. You know, we got to the end of our adjustments and we were like, nope, that's still not bad. That's still getting better. You know, and we actually then had to go and do some kind of things to kind of like get around that, or make, you know, interesting things, should we say. We played around with bottom bracket drop, and we got to where we thought would be, you know, way disruptive, you know, and we were like, no, that's still kind of okay. And we had to then go and kind of machine some new bit. Well, in fact, we just grew some rapid prototype new parts to kind of be able to adjust bottom bracket even more, and then go and try that. And we did then get to the point where it was disruptive, which is what we were looking for, really, as engineers. We want to find the limits and then be able to go, okay, well, one step back is what we want then, you know, or two steps back. So yeah, that was really interesting opportunity at all of those races there. And we were also just gathering data at all those races as well. So we run our own data acquisition systems on the bikes with Kirk there. And it was nice to have that kind of a little bit away from the main race team, you know, so that we were running data acquisition on finals runs with Kirk. You know, Kirk was kind enough to agree to do that and take that kind of risk on the finals run there to allow us to see that, you know, actual full race pace, you know, data, and even learn some of the setup things there about, you know, okay, well, you know, the difference between a quali pace and a race pace, what is that and what do we need to do in terms of setup. So yeah, really interesting time on the road there doing that work with the mule.
Yeah, certainly sounds like it. And one thing that I'm sort of curious for both of your thoughts on is that, Adrian, you spoke a little earlier about, you know, having this very straightforward goal of being, we're going to build the fastest race bike we can for the World Cup race tracks that, you know, they change a little bit, but you've got a relatively limited number of tracks that you're trying to kind of focus on. And that certainly narrows the scope a bit, as you said. But how much do you think that what constitutes the fastest race bike is also just dependent on rider preferences and riding style and so on and so forth? And so this idea of there being kind of a singular fastest bike, how much does that theoretical idealized bike even, is that even possible in a broad sense, or is it, how dependent is it on the rider that's going to be piloting it too?
Yeah, I mean, this is definitely Kirk's area of expertise. Like, he should answer it more in a minute, but it is funny that you mentioned that, because at the beginning when we were doing that kind of modeling work or that weighting, we had this kind of rider versus bike kind of element to it for ages. And, you know, there was, for everybody we spoke to, there was a difference of opinion, you know, on the, how much, which was important, you know. And actually we just had to put the rider element aside for a bit, you know, and just say, okay, well, of however much percent is bike, you know, what's important there. But yeah, rider preference. Yeah, definitely something we've experienced, a good amount over the course of this, Kirk, I mean, yeah, definitely. You are the expert on this, right?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I may have actually swayed, you know, toward there being maybe more of a singular good setup throughout this process of testing the bike, because it does seem like, although, you know, myself and the team riders have different styles or, you know, body proportions or whatnot, it does seem like we kind of all converge on quite similar settings. And even, you know, I'm sure we'll talk more about having Greg in the mix, but, you know, it's almost, I don't know, exciting to see it as a test rider, you know, when, you know, we're kind of working on our own, developing some settings, and then bring them to the team and they like them too. And it's like, oh, sweet. Like, you know, maybe there is actually like the kind of Goldilocks little zone there. And we have a little bit of wiggle room within that. But I think that, yeah, I think through this project, I've kind of maybe been swayed over to more the thinking that there is kind of, you know, a prime setup that does work pretty well for everybody.
That's interesting. And I mean, I think the point that Adrian made a little earlier too, that the bike industry as a whole has just quite substantially narrowed, sort of like, you know, jointly converged on, certainly not exactly the same answer, but sort of the range of different things that people are doing with, you know, pick a variable, geometry, suspension, kinematics, all of this stuff has, to some extent at least, converged in the last not that many years. And we're just kind of learning and settling on what does and doesn't work for a given application, given scenario, what have you. And so, yeah, I'm not surprised here that there's a certain amount of wiggle room, but that the sort of breadth of things that could be ideal for, you know, a handful of different riders is maybe not that huge either.
To sort of, yeah, take this to plug some of Colin's work with the ride line stuff that we use on our production bike, like we kind of use that same sort of algorithm that we use in ride line to, you know, be able to translate these setups between, like, you know, me or Gracie, you know, obviously very different size people, but yeah, with a lot of the research we've done on that side, you know, in terms of weight distribution and rider position and stuff, we can get really close in just transferring my settings over to Gracie, which has been really cool.
Yeah, the skill is in just knowing how much to scale, isn't it, for weight or height or, you know, body position on the bike, etc., which is, again, something I genuinely think, you know, it's probably the work that we do on rider lines that has educated us in that area, you know, some of the work around rider weight distribution that we do, and then obviously actually the individual bike setups, you know, where you and Arthur or Colin were out there generating the setups, and then we scale them, say, for a heavier rider like me or a lighter rider like Gracie, and then we get the feedback and we've learned what works and what doesn't work, and we go, oh, actually, once you get to this point of this characteristic, you know, the scale changes, etc. So, you know, we've got a lot of information and data that's helped us on there, and I think, yeah, you're right, it really has come from some of that ride along work.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting. And I guess we should go into some more of the details of the race bike itself. We've kind of been dancing around that a bit. Sort of floor is yours, I guess. Tell us what you have arrived at as far as the design goes.
Yeah, so coming out, when we came out of the mule there, we knew that we then, you know, we wanted to refine that bike somewhat from the mule, and make it, you know, make it the actual race bike that we're going to give to the team, so more of a polished product. So there was definitely some of the characteristics that we knew, okay, we've experimented here. We know, like I said earlier, we know 1, 2, and 3 are good options, but 4 and 5 you'll never use. So we'll reduce down the adjustability. There were some areas where we said, you know, it was great to have the adjustability, but we know what we feel is probably going to work best as one fixed position. So we'll just get rid of the adjustment, make the bike simpler and more reliable. Yeah, and then we went into a design phase with this new bike. It was quite a short design phase, to be fair. We kind of, you know, we were given kind of a target race to achieve, and yeah, we had probably a little bit less time than we would have wanted, but that's always good. A little bit of pressure, you know, gets things moving. I guess the biggest change really to talk about is probably the fact that the Mule was a full 29 bike, and then the current race bike is an MX bike. So that's definitely the biggest change there. And that came out of a team camp that we ran with the riders at the time and Kirk. And yeah, I don't know if you want to pick up on that a bit, Kirk, on that change. It's a little bit closer to that wheel than me.
Yeah. So that would have been a little over a year ago that we kind of did the bulk of that testing, like Adrian said, at a team camp here. And yeah, I mean, I think it was sort of all of our first proper experience doing some like good back-to-back testing. Actually, I guess Mark Wallace at the time had done something similar with his past bike brand, but yeah, we were kind of just, I guess, interested in, you know, what one was the fastest and also what one we were most comfy on to really be able to push on. And I think we found on both those things that the MX bike allowed us to be faster and also feel more comfortable doing it. So since that test, we've kind of, you know, we've been able to design the new bike to like convert between both, but you know, we wanted to kind of design it as like an MX primary bike with the ability to convert to 29 inch rear wheel, and then sort of the one difference when you make that conversion is that because of correcting for the wheel size, the 29 bike will have a little bit less rearward axle path than the 27.5 bike. And then, you know, I think that kind of works out nicely as well, where you can see that maybe the 29 bike doesn't need as much rearward axle path just because that big wheel can kind of eat up the bumps on its own. So, yeah, we've been kind of full steam on the 27.5 bike since then. Minus a little bit of recent testing with Greg that we can dive into in a bit if you'd like, but
it's quite interesting when we looked at that, because we were coming from a 29 only Mule, and when we were at that point, we kind of we were looking at whether we could make a bike that was convertible to mixed wheel size, and it was looking quite challenging to come from the 29. And that's why we said, okay, well, let's go one way or the other. Also, there's all sorts of other operational, you know, implications here to take into account. You know, it probably would be, and also because of the time period, we said, look, we've got time to make one or the other at the moment. So we fixed on that 27 coming out of the camp there. And also, you know, from looking at the demands of different current World Cup tracks, you know, you also can't hide from looking at what everybody else is doing. There's a lot of group knowledge out there. You know, if you're the only one doing something different, it doesn't always mean you've made the right choice. So we made that change, and it was a mixed wheel size bike. But then recently, you know, as Kirk alluded to, we revisited it recently. At the request of somebody, and actually going back the other way, we managed to find that it was a bit easier to do it going back the other way. So having made a front triangle and linkage layout that worked with as an MX bike, going back to being a 29 was actually an easier design solution for us. You know, it's got a different rear end and one of the links changes, but we don't have the compromises that we're going to have the other way. And as you said earlier, the idea is we change one thing alone in isolation, and we can understand that. We don't want to change the wheel, you know, with a chip or something. And you know, now we've got all these geo changes as well, and the bottom bracket drop changes, you know, and then the rider says, yeah, this is great. You don't know, was it the wheel or was it the something else about the geo? So going from the mixed wheel size bike that we have now to 29, we've managed to achieve that. You know, the only other change, as Kirk says, is the axle path. So yeah, that's been really good for us to go back out and then do some of that that back-to-back testing again.
Yeah, that's something that I think has maybe gone a little bit under-discussed sort of in the bike world of late, is that there are a ton of bikes out there that are convertible between running a full 29er or a mullet setup. And we get asked a bunch, like, you know, you'll see some new bike that gets launched that doesn't feature that convertibility. And people are like, oh, well, why didn't they bother making it convertible? And it's like, well, it's, you know, sure, you can just put a flip chip on the lower shock mount or whatever and correct for the geometry, but that's got other impacts too. And kind of got into this with someone who was basically sort of took issue with, I've made comments before that I have by and large gotten along better with bikes that are convertible in the 29er setting, in large part because most of the time when you make a bike convertible, you end up making the chainstays shorter in the mullet setup, just as it's done in practice. Not necessarily that that has to be the case 100% of the time, but look at the bikes that are on the market. That is often the case. And some things about that have not always worked out well for me, but there are plenty of mullet bikes that I like quite well, but they tend to be bikes that are designed as a dedicated mullet frame rather than trying to make a convertible one. And there's no free lunch in terms of just make it convertible. So I guess I'll step off that soapbox now, but makes sense that it's not as straightforward as it might appear at first blush.
Yeah, but I mean, if, certainly for a race bike, you know, you know, I think we're at the pinnacle here, you know, with the best athletes, you know, on these bikes here, or you know, professional athletes on these bikes here. I think that at this point of the spectrum, we need to maybe have to make these changes independently and not kind of chase ourselves when we make these changes. I think there's a place for it in production bikes if it's done well. We have done it on our Sight and Optic platform, you know, but it is you know, not a chip on there. We purposely made the change so that we made it so that we felt both bikes ride as well as each other, you know, and we don't have to have the compromises. And, you know, you don't have to go and get your shock retuned or, you know, whatever else you need to do there. So, yeah, I think, I would just say, yeah, on a downhill race bike, it was very important to us that we didn't have any other complications from changing wheel size.
Right. And Kirk, from that camp that you touched on a moment ago, where you settled on making the race bike mixed wheel as the primary setup anyway, just would be curious to hear more about what you guys found in that bit of testing that led you to that decision. I mean, you mentioned just it being faster, but were there specific sort of types of conditions or bits of tracks where the advantages of the mixed wheel setup stood out most clearly? Or just, I don't know, floor is yours, I suppose, but kind of be curious to hear some more about that in a bit more detail.
Yeah, well, the few things that, you know, I can recall is just like the I don't know, making a word, turnability. I don't know that how the bike, you're able to just find small, like, I don't know, little tiny ruts or like a you know, a little bit of support and able to just turn the bike really quickly off of that. And, you know, make a quick direction change without necessarily needing to kind of sweep it around like a 29 bike, which I thought was a really big advantage. And I think that especially is relevant on a lot of World Cup tracks, where compared to what we test on here, are quite like hard packed and slippery. So being able to leverage that to just turn really quickly off of like a tiny little bit of support, was, yeah, a big thing for me that I was like, yeah, this is going to be the way to go. And then I think for me, like, coming back to that sort of first impression of the bike, feeling like a bit of a trophy truck, like I was like, man, this thing works so good in that kind of like straight line rough anyways, that I don't really think we need a big wheel back there to like help it roll over and carry speed. I think, you know, that's a big a big positive to the sort of rearward axle path of the bike. Just that momentum carry ability, you know. So I didn't really feel like the 27.5 wheel in the back was going to be a hindrance there.
And to be fair, like in the, you know, we tested this recently in our Portugal test camp, and you know, there's some obvious things you expect. You know, okay, it's twisty at the top. When we test the 27, it'll be faster up there. There's a motorway section at the bottom. The 29 will be faster there. You know, it's pretty obvious, is what everybody says and has seen before. And then we did this back-to-back testing. We did a lot of back-to-back testing, you know, at our test camp this year on wheel size, because we really wanted to dig into it, and we had this great opportunity of you know, another set of eyes on the problem. And we were pulling the timing off and finding, yeah, of course, yeah, top section faster on the 27 wheel, bottom section faster on the 27 wheel, you know, and yeah, that definitely had us puzzling for a while there, you know, like and digging into why we might think that is, and we've got some better understanding, some thoughts on why that might be. But yeah, I mean, it speaks to what Kirk's saying there. You know, this bike and platform does seem to kind of overcome some of the needs for that bigger rear wheel. So yeah, definitely from the qualitative rider feedback and also the stopwatch, you know, we're both kind of agreeing on that there, which is good that we went in that direction for the primary bike design.
Okay. That's interesting. And I guess to sort of keep going with the primary bike design, tell us a bit more about where you've ended up with the suspension layout and so on, because visually there's definitely some similarity to the range, but things get a bit more different once you peel back the curtain a little more. So tell us about it.
Yeah, for sure. Maybe we can walk through the bike a little bit, yeah, on that. So yeah, visually it is some similarities. You've got this lower link, which is, you know, placed around the bottom bracket, but critically it's not concentric like it was on the range, which not only for some kinematic reasons there, but also from some packaging and logistics reasons there, of not trying to put all those things around each other at the bottom, it's a lot better. The main difference then to the range is we then add another link into the system. So we've got a push rod just to join two links together, and then an upper lever arm, which then is what actually drives the shock. And that's kind of, I guess, really was the key layout change that we'll move into with range. And Colin looked at the kinematic limitations of range and where he wanted to go. And he had an idea of where he wanted, you know, leverage to be and how he wanted anti-rise and wheel path to look compared to that as well. And knew he, you know, that's what, you know, essentially what he, some of the things that he couldn't get to with range, equally some of the things he wanted to keep from range, you know, some of those characteristics. And kind of came up with this idea of decoupling the two links from each other to allow the shock to be driven by the upper link, and then kind of came to me with that and said, okay, well, look, this is what it looks like in 2D, you know, and I kind of, you know, sucked my teeth a little bit because, you know, about it, and said, well, you know, you've got to get some bearings in this thing, or we've got to do this and got to do that, and, you know, have you seen the loads that you're putting in here and what have you? But yeah, between us, we managed to make that work, and you've got some, you know, there's some neat little tricks and stuff that we've done in there and the bearing arrangements and what have you to make that work. Yeah, so on the kinematic side, that's really the big difference, is that the shock is driven by that upper link. And, you know, Kirk's a little bit more of an expert on the actual kinematics than me, so maybe he can, you know, if you want to dig in more, you can ask Kirk in a second. Then we've got rear center adjust, you know, which we did have on range, to be fair, but, you know, it's a little bit more refined now on this bike there. We've got reach adjust on this bike. As I said earlier, it's kind of stack corrected reach adjust. So different cups that we've got at the head set there. We don't have bottom bracket adjust on this bike, which I think is probably pretty obvious to most people. You know, we got rid of those kind of cups that we had on the mule because we found where we thought was going to be where we wanted to be. And then the really interesting thing there, which is something that Colin's actually just filed a patent for as well, which is that we've got this adjustment on the progression settings. And yeah, again, probably Kirk is the better to speak about this with a little bit more accuracy. So yeah, maybe on the kinematics, you've got a bit more to say about those adjustments, Kirk.
Yeah, well, yeah, I guess there's a theme to all of this, and that's kind of, you know, isolation, right? And yeah, again, like as a test rider, has been so good for me personally to, you know, have this learning of being able to test everything in isolation. And so like Adrian was touching on with the progression to just Colin has kind of come up with this way to just shift the shock along its axis, which changes the slope of the leverage curve without altering the starting leverage, which is like probably our most used adjustment on the bike, really. Like everybody has kind of, you know, like we were saying earlier, we've kind of zeroed in on our sort of everybody's quite close to our middle setting, but you know, from track to track can really easily play around with that, and you're not having to change your spring rate or shock settings. To me, probably like the most valuable adjustment on the bike, and again, it's just in isolation of any other adjustment. Coming back to the Colin's kind of six link layout and the kinematic, decoupling, you know, things from each other, decoupling that anti-squat curve that we, the anti-squat that we really like from the range DH, from, you know, the leverage curve, and axle path and stuff, so that we can, kind of just be able to, you know, pick each characteristic that we like individually, and kind of just, yeah, create this one great, like, kind of layout.
And the final adjustment on the bike to speak about is we've got some adjustment around the idler there, so we can tune some of the characteristics that come from idler position as well on the bike, which is something we carried forward from the mule. We found that was a useful tuning tool as well, useful setup tool as well. So we carried that forward. Yeah.
Cool. We've sort of touched on the fact that the team has changed a bit since you started working on the project, and obviously sort of the headline there is that you've got Greg Minar on board now. And well, apart from the request for a full 29er setup that apparently came out of that, how's that been, sort of having this change in the team and having him come on board and figure out bike setup for someone new, and having just a different set of inputs coming from a new rider who's getting figured out on the bike for the first time?
Yeah, I start probably with the team structure side of things, because, you know, having Greg coming onto the team is the headline, but behind the scenes as well, there is this much bigger team structure that we've built out recently. We have, like I say, this whole bike project came out of an ask from Norco that, you know, we increase our presence in downhill and improve our results in downhill fundamentally, which is, you know, how you increase your presence, really. And really that ask got, you know, doubled or trebled or, you know, 10 times, you know, last year. You know, it's like, no, really, you know, let's go for this. You know, you've done the mule, now let's get the race bike out there. And the attention and focus on the team increased. And so, Greg came on board, late last year, but there was already kind of movement around building out the team with a little bit more resources. We've, as you know, the structure really at the top is this kind of this triangle of having Alan, Kathy, and Tom in the team, and each having their own area of team management to guard. You know, so you've got Kathy, which is fundamentally the greatest logistical operator in World Cup downhill racing. You know, everything we ever need is sorted before we even need it, you know, and that's fantastic to have her on the operational side, and she heads up the operational side now of the team. And then we wanted to decouple the technical side there, so that, you know, you have somebody at the track who is like your focus on all of the technical stuff, so that's bike setup, and everything to do with the bike side of things and the rider's kind of bike setup. And equally then to have the athletic performance pulled out as its own separate, I don't know, corporate people called it a pillar or something like that, I guess, but its own area of expertise. So then we've got Alan coming in. He's just focused on the athletic performance. So he's just looking at the athlete and what they need, you know, their strength training, their physical preparations, their fueling, you know, everything that the athlete needs. And, you know, before we didn't have three people doing those tasks, you know, so like we've just built out this much bigger structure there. The same with the mechanics, you know, we've got and retained, you know, the best mechanics, you know, for our team. And so there, so yeah, the structure's really building out from there. And then, yeah, obviously Greg comes on board, you know, it's this fantastic opportunity to work with, you know, greatest of all time, you know, the fantastic rider that can just bring so much experience to us, both on the technical side, you know, he's been there, he's seen everything in the last, you know, many decades, you know, so just the ability for him to come into the technical side and to use that experience, you know, you take, for example, the mixed wheel size testing. He's got some experience in that game, you know, for sure, you know, and he's got some personal preferences as well that we want to go and experiment with. And the sheer focus of Greg when we got into that testing, you know, when we were at the testing camp this year and we were doing that wheel testing, you know, he was the first rider up the hill and the last one down, you know, and he was constantly focused on this testing with us and just getting into the technical side of things and equally fantastically open to the whole process as well, you know, so despite the many years of experience either way with all of these different design challenges that we're going through, you know, really open to listening to the thoughts that me, Kirk and Colin have got, you know, and to work with us and work within our process and, you know, and also to make our process better with his experience. So yeah, it's been genuinely fantastic, you know, since we first met Greg in December. You know, we went out and did a little test with him out near Andorra. You know, met him for the first time and put him on our bike for the first time, which is not nerve-wracking, shall we say, but, you know, equally a fantastic experience to go out there and to get his feedback on the bike. It's just been great the whole way through. I remember the first time that he came, you know, we'd met him the night before and there's a good laugh to be had the night before and meeting Greg for the first time. And then we got to work the next day. And I remember, you know, me and Colin sort of looked at each other as he drove up in the shuttle for his first run down on our bike. And I think there was some genuine nervousness between us, you know, and what his thoughts might be. You know, it was obviously going to mean a lot to how this project went forward. And he came down the hill and his first reaction, you know, genuinely and honestly was, this is a bike I think I can win on. That's, you know, okay, that's a pretty good feedback on the bike for the first time down, you know, I hope we carry that through. I hope that's not just, you know, I hope we just don't stop there, obviously. But, you know, I think it makes the point that he had some confidence in that bike and there's a lot of things going on that bike that he rode for the first time, which you would, you know, perhaps expect, given Greg's experience, to not gel with quite as much, you know, high pivot, mixed wheel size, etc. It's very different to the bike that he was coming off of. So yeah, that was a very good experience. And obviously, yeah, since then, you know, we've had to do a hell of a lot more work, you know, to actually, you know, that's first ride down the hill, isn't it? You know, it always feels good on a new bike, doesn't it? From this new bike day, you know. But yeah, the process is fantastic so far.
Well, and I guess how much have you felt like you have wanted to tweak and adapt things based on Greg's feedback versus the point that you were at when he came on board the team being just pretty close to being, you know, the bike that he wanted to be on?
I don't think we're that far away. You know, I don't think there's a radical tear up anywhere. You know, I don't think at any point has there been like, no, you guys are wrong about this, you know, like, or more to the point, it's like, you know, you guys are right, but this doesn't suit me. You know, actually, I need this, you know, a little bit like what Kirk was saying about before, you know, about actually we're kind of finding that what we've got here does seem to work, you know, for a plethora of different rider styles and body makeups. I think it has felt more like tweaking, to be honest with you, you know, and some more experimentation. But I don't think there's really fundamentally anything particularly different on the bike. there's obviously some developments, you know, the whole idea of this being a race bike is that we can continue to develop. You know, there isn't a point that someone says, right, stop, we've got to cut a mold now. You know, we need to sell this thing, you know. So, you know, we had some things that were our winter projects this year that we brought to that test, you know, and those directions that we were heading did by and large work, you know, and they were improvements to the bike, and that was true as much for Gracie as it was for Greg, as it was for Kirk or Lucas. So, yeah, I did. Yeah, Kirk?
Yeah, like just to build on that, I think it was the same as Aiden and Colin. I was nervous about his impression of the bike, and it was super validating to hear his positive feedback, because, you know, like me as a test rider is providing, you know, feedback on the direction of the bike is kind of like, I think I know what a bike needs to feel like and, you know, handle like in order to win a World Cup, but I've never won a World Cup myself. So, you know, I was like, is Greg going to hop on this thing and be like, oh, this thing's like a couch, it's too soft, you know, like, or some other direction that he feels like in, you know, the World Cup winning sort of direction. So yeah, super, super just validating and, you know, relieving, I guess, to get his positive feedback as well.
Mm. But equally starts to build the nerves going into the beginning of the season as well. From my side, you know, now, you know, we're starting to get to the sharp end again. You know, this is all, it's all well and good testing, but, you know, we've got a race in 2 weeks. So, yeah, that's where the nerves start to build again now, to make sure that we actually do come out and put our money where our mouth is, because, you know, that's our job and that's what the mission is here. So hopefully the performance comes with the bike and with the riders this year.
Yeah, that first race is coming right up here. And, well, Adrian, you mentioned that you're approaching this as just being a continued development project of the race bike without a particular, you know, set of end goalposts for bringing it to production. Not ruling it out necessarily, but not that, you know, having that not be the ultimate specific end goal, I guess. Do you have more stuff that you want to try and change and experiment with, or are you feeling like things are in a pretty stable place and you're just working on setup and details at this point?
I think a bit of both, to be honest, is the honest answer. I feel like we've got a pretty stable platform now to race with, you know, and I don't think there's a massive crying ask from anybody on the team, you know, to be like, oh, we've got to fix this characteristic or this characteristic. But I think that's also going to allow us to start to turn our attention to, okay, what next? You know, where do we want to experiment next? And we've got a list of things that we want to experiment into next. And I think that's what will happen, is that we will kind of split off again from the race team, you know, and start to think about what the next thing is we want and make some parts, you know, and go and do some experiments, whether that be Kirk when he's home and around, or whether that's Kirk at the race. You know, if we can get it refined enough that we are comfortable to put that to the race track environment, or at least for practice, you know, and that's how I would see it going forward, really, is we've got this great opportunity. We've got one of our engineers or races on the World Cup, you know, like, which I'm pretty sure there is nobody else doing that anymore. I don't know, maybe check me on that later. But yeah, we've got this fantastic opportunity, and we can, you know, it's a bit like how we would used to do it in Formula One. You know, we would bring new things to the track on a Friday, because it was the only environment really that you had left to practice or to test these things. And you could run things in free practice and you'd learn something about it then. And then you could take it off for the race and put the normal stuff that you knew was reliable, you knew worked, you know, knew wasn't a risk to the race, and you race that. And then next Friday you put it back on and learn something else, and eventually you go, you know what, that's actually better now, so let's put that on the race bike. So I think that's how we would go forward. Some little things like that coming out and being like, hey, Kirk, we've done this change to, you know, whatever, the idler. You know, can you put that on for Friday with your mechanic and give some feedback, but don't race it, you know. And then at the same time, I want us to also start to think about what the big next development direction is. You know, what's the next big thing that might add performance to the bike? You know, how can we check that out? You know, and let's make that something big, you know, like a change to kinematics that actually requires another mule, or, you know, some other change to layout that requires another mule, or, you know, taking weight out of an area of the bike, or adding weight to an area of the bike. You know, let's go and experiment with those things completely separately and offline, to kind of just keep driving our knowledge forward. Because the big thing for us as well as a production bike company is that all of this stuff feeds into all of our commercial projects. You know, we always said that at the beginning of this, you know, it was always a good argument for why we should spend a bit more time resource on this. It's like, oh, it'll trickle down, you know, it's a good kind of catchphrase, but actually, you know, it even surprises me how much of it does actually trickle down onto our production bikes, you know, now.
So. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense that you would have ideas and things that you want to try, but at some point you need to stop throwing a million new random ideas at the race team and let them just focus on dialing in the bike and getting comfortable on it and all that. And so sort of splitting back off and doing some of that more experimental stuff in parallel. Makes a lot of sense. Well, guys, it's been a pretty good rundown on the bike, and just, I think, a very interesting look behind the curtain on a lot of the thinking behind it. So very much appreciate that. And very much looking forward to downhill World Cup race and getting fired back up again quite shortly here. So thank you for the time and for the insights. Any final parting thoughts to put out there, or shall we wrap it there?
Nothing for me. I appreciate you having us. I'm also stoked for some downhill racing.
Yeah, same. Just, yeah, appreciate the time to talk to you there. It's been really interesting to just go back down memory lane, actually, even though it's only a couple of years. But even when we talked this morning about this podcast, just remembering some of the things we've done and the crazy experiments and the, you know, wet car parks and Cyprus and all of this. Yeah, it's been really fun to think back about that and share it with you guys. And yeah, now it's put our money where our mouth is and get to Fort William.
Yeah, well, once again, very much appreciate you coming on, and best of luck with the season going forward. Really looking forward to watching all of it.
Thank you.
Thanks.
All right. That's it for this edition of Bikes and Big Ideas. And as always, we would appreciate you leaving us a rating or review in your podcast player of choice to help keep the show going and growing. I'd also like to say thanks to Kirk and Adrian for the conversation. Thanks to Taylor Ahern for producing the episode. And thanks to you for listening. From all of us at Blister, please take good care of yourself and everybody else. And we'll be back again next week. Bye, everybody.